All right, George, here okay. we go.
Great.
Feel pumped? Feel good?
Pretty pumped.
All right. We're not going to put this in.
This is just us getting ready.
Everybody listening, we're not going to put this in the podcast. This is me warming up my voice.
Edit right over this.
Life at last, salutations from the other side. I can see that you're the devil's pride. Do you realize that all of you don't have some hope? Or you hated that was part of you?
Everybody, to the third edition of Worst Scene, Best Scene, a podcast where we watch two movies, a great one and a not so great one. We then discuss what we consider the worst scene in the great one and the best scene in the bad one. As has been true since the beginning of time and will also remain true until its end, I'm your host, Richard, and here with me is your other host, Eternal,
George.
In today's episode, we're going to look at two adaptations of The Phantom of the Opera. The Phantom of the Paradise by Brian De Palma, a movie that, at the time of its release in 1974, completely bombed everywhere in the world outside of Winnipeg and kind of in Paris. But since then, it's only seen its esteem and influence skyrocket.
We're also going to be looking at 1989's Phantom of the Opera, starring Freddy Krueger himself, Robert Englund, a film that didn't do so great either.
And whose esteem has also not really increased.
Or decreased.
It's just keeping level.
It's staying level.
Not too bad. But going back to our good movie, our great movie, Phantom of the Paradise, as is true with many great films, Phantom of the Paradise was not all that widely acclaimed upon its release. Vincent Canby of the New York Times said it was an elaborate disaster, full of the kind of humor you find on bumper stickers and cocktail coasters.
Ooh.
Not great.
Oh.
However, the great Pauline Kael, she said of Phantom that it has lift to it. You practically get a kinetic charge from the breakneck wit that De Palma has put into Phantom. It isn't just that the picture has vitality, but that one can feel the tremendous kick the director got out of making it. Oh. De Palma, of course, has talked about The Phantom as well. And he says, I think I learned something symbolic from the original release of our movie that has stayed with me all these years. If Phantom of the Paradise had been a hit when it was released, even a modest one in 1974, it might not have grown the legions of fans we see today. I think that's because it hung around a while. And people still get that thrill of discovery, a certain pride of ownership about this movie when they find it. They feel like it belongs to them. And the big spiritual lesson for me? It's sort of simple. Don't ever write something off as a failure too quickly. You never know what's going to happen down the line.
Wow. That's great. That's great advice.
It is great advice. And before I throw it to you, I'll note one more thing. So the set dresser on Phantom of the Paradise, who did an amazing job because the sets look incredible.
Sure.
Sissy Spacek, who 2 years later would star in Brian De Palma's Carrie.
Yeah. Basically cement both of their careers with that movie.
Yeah. So now the point of this podcast.
Sure.
At least one of the points is to choose the worst scene in this great film. And George, why don't you start us off?
Well, before we get too far away from this whole comment about Winnipeg, where it did phenomenally well, I have the numbers here. So it was a disappointment everywhere, but it opened in Winnipeg on December 26th, 1974, and then it closed on May 1st, 1975. That's 18 weeks to you and me. So from that same era, Jaws played in Winnipeg for 16 weeks, which is great. But Rocky Horror Picture Show, released almost a year later, played for only 4 weeks. So I have no correlations to draw there whatsoever. It's just a fact. Okay, you guys, if you can't deal with facts, then this podcast may or may not be for you. Again, I do not take sides, and I do not make definitive answers about anything for the most part.
And for anyone, if you haven't watched Phantom of the Paradise, you may not realize that Rocky Horror Picture Show, I mean, they're both musicals.
Yeah.
And if you like one, there's a good chance you'll like the other. But Phantom of the Paradise is definitely a superior film to the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
As far as the narrative structure goes and the cinematography and The performances in both are fantastic. I will not say a bad word about Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, no, no, absolutely
but
not.
What's also kind of weird about this era is that, so this is the mid-70s, and this is really when Alice Cooper is starting to come into his own as a really bizarre grand guignol, I don't know how to say that word, so I'm just going to keep going, rock and roll performer. Black Sabbath is already kind of established. So you've got Rocky Horror, the stage show, that becomes this really weird underground hit. And then you've got Alice Cooper, and then Kiss starts to happen, and you've got Phantom of the Paradise. And it's just this really weird start of something that I think eventually morphs in some weird way into like the metal stuff you got in the early 80s with Iron Maiden and their huge stage shows. But it's this weird zeitgeist of kind of horror rock coming not too far on the heels of... what is it? The nostalgia wave, which is also mentioned in the opening narration of Phantom of the Paradise, performed by Mr. Rod Serling.
Swan. He has no other name. His past is a mystery, but his work is already a legend. He wrote and produced his first gold record at 14. In the years since then, he has won so many others that he once tried to deposit them in Fort Knox.
But this movie is one of my favorite movies. So I'm having a hard time trying to find a scene that fits in with what our podcast is all about. So bear with me. This is going to take a little while. My God. You know what you said about De Palma's quote, I saw this years ago at a midnight show in San Francisco. And Paul Williams was there. Paul Williams actually announced it. And there was a little Q&A with him before the show. He had just been performing in the city. And he said that he knows exactly who you are. When you come up to him on the street and you tell him, my favorite work you've ever done is Phantom of the Paradise. He knows exactly who we are. You know, he understands that we are his mutants. We are this one weird mutant side of his career. His very successful career, I must say, as he was nominated for an Oscar for this movie. It was nice that he acknowledged all of us. All right, I have some factoids, but I'll...
Please, lay them out.
Okay. Well, they're not even factoids. I love watching this movie. There are so many crazy tracking shots where the Phantom screaming and running down hallways. It's just the action of the camera is incomparable. And there's other stuff where it's these really weird, sweeping, moving camera... things and camera things. That's right. Even if you don't like Scarface, you should watch Scarface because De Palma has this obsession with filming mirrors. And this is this happens a bit in Phantom of the Paradise. And it's just kind of like, how can I make my cinematographer's life a living hell and make them figure out something that is not possible? There's a scene in a nightclub in Scarface where there's a shootout and all the walls are mirror. It's an amazing magic trick of cinema. So, I am required by law to pick a worse scene in this movie.
By law.
By law.
We have with us a police officer who will arrest you if you do not choose.
Not only is it required, worse scene. Yes. Not only is it required by law, it is one of our bylaws. Hey.
Hey.
Jokes. All right. So, first I thought, what about the opening scene when Philbin is talking to the camera? The camera being Swan, the unseen Swan, the mysterious Swan. And I thought, well, this is all exposition. You know, it's a guy talking to the camera, kind of laying out things. And, you know, right after Rod Serling has just done the opening narration. And I thought, like, oh, is this all exposition? Is this a little clunky? Is it kind of awkward? But no, not really, because it also helps with the world building. And it's pretty immediate that they're building this entire world where Swan, who I'm pretty sure is some kind of metaphor for Phil Spector being... the devil, or if not the devil, one of the devil's henchmen. And so, yeah, I can't pick that because, like, well, you need that. It really helps you establish this menace, this creepy Godfather-esque menace. Okay, so that's out. and then I thought, like, well, if I really sat down and thought, what's my least favorite scene in the movie? My least favorite scene is when Beef is killed, because Beef is... one of the greatest film characters of all time. Not just my lifetime, of all time. Beef is fucking believable.
Man, you better get yourself a castrato for this, because it's a little out of my range.
Something bothering you, Beef?
Swan, this was scored for a chick.
His outfits are amazing. Garrett Graham plays Beef, and it is such a complete performance. It toes the line of being caricature and then goes right over it and becomes something real. I don't understand it. I don't understand how something could be this good and so many people haven't seen it and don't love it the way that I love it. So I thought, well, when they kill Beef, that sucks because then he's not in the movie anymore and he is my favorite thing, hands down. But it's a great death scene and it's very necessary because without him dying, then Phoenix doesn't get the call up to the big league. So there you go. Side note, if you like Garrett Graham, well, let's become friends on Facebook, first off. And also check out Chud 2, Bud the Chud. I think one of the taglines was, "This Chud's for you." And Garrett Graham plays the titular role of Bud the Chud.
Also, side note.
Yeah. Ooh.
If you are taking part and are slowly developing drinking games.
Oh, yeah. You just got two.
When George says, side note, you should drink. I don't say side note that often. In fact, you should drink when I say in context, based upon me listening to and editing this thing. I say in context a lot. So if you hear me say that, even right now, you should drink.
And again, I am sorry for any damage incurred, but not responsible for it. Also, if anyone out there wants to make me one of those deer antler belts that Beef wears, please, please contact us. And I would be glad to take possession of it. All right, so then I thought, okay, that won't work. How about the scene where the Phantom watches Swan's tape, where Swan has made the tape of himself saying, I'm going to commit suicide, and then he is approached by his own mirror image, who I guess is the devil.
Why not?
What?
Stay young forever. I'm real, and I'll leave if you want, but you did call me.
I didn't call anybody.
You said you wanted to be young forever.
Here's my problem with that, is that you're watching this as if you are the Phantom. You're watching it on a TV screen, and if you haven't seen this scene, what I'm about to say will make no sense at all. Even if you have seen it, there's a great chance this won't make any sense. But so you're watching it, it's all set up. You can see that Swan has set up a camera, and he's talking to the camera. All right, so let's say you were taking a selfie or you were doing a video of your face into your camera and someone was watching that video and all of a sudden they saw a shot from the other angle, the reverse angle of that. It's like, wait, there's only one camera. How is that other shot happening? That's cheating. That's not right. But then you realize that he has tapes on everyone else and they have weird camera angles where they couldn't have had camera angles. So it's really not about the camera. This is the devil's own footage. So that logic makes sense, and therefore I can't pick this scene. Okay, this is very much like deciding the poison in Princess Bride, which we might cover in the future.
I'm sure we will, actually.
Okay, Jesus Christ. So are we half an hour in and I haven't done anything? I haven't achieved anything? All right.
No, I think we're at our normal point where you haven't achieved anything yet.
Great. So I guess this is going to be my pick. Okay, so Beef dies. And Phoenix comes to the rescue and performs beautifully. The crowd eats out of the palm of her hand. So the scene I've picked is right after that. She's in the dressing room and Swan comes back.
You're going to be a very big star, Phoenix. We'll finish the cantata tomorrow night. We'll record, we'll go on tour, and then there are no words to express what you're going to become.
I'll do anything you want. I owe you everything. Just give me that crowd again.
And so it's not that it's a bad scene or that it's badly acted or badly shot or badly written. It's a good scene. But the character motivation isn't quite there. You get the idea that Phoenix wants to be successful and is a great performer, an amazing singer, but you don't get the idea that she has this kind of craven power lust that she displays in this scene and then the subsequent scenes. And so I thought, like, yeah, maybe some foreshadowing that, because the first time you see her, She is unwilling to get on the casting couch.
Won't he just let me sing?
What's the matter?
Filming director. I just can't do it, not that way. I came here to sing.
Doesn't even sound like an audition.
Leave me alone.
I'm sorry, did you tell him who I am?
And then after that, she does her audition where she's really proud and independent and ferocious. So then I was thinking, like, okay, well, maybe it's up to the audience to fill in the blanks. You know, she had the lead because the Phantom wants her to have the lead. And then when Beef comes along, she's pushed to the chorus. So maybe it's that. Maybe it's that she's been slighted and she wants to get back in the spotlight. I guess. I mean, it makes sense. You know, it certainly makes enough sense for me to maybe not pick this scene. But if I don't pick this scene, I won't pick any scene. So I'm going to pick this, even though, yeah, you know what, actually, so then she meets up with the Phantom right after this scene, and he warns her. Of course, it's really scary, and she goes right back into Swan's arms, so it doesn't really work. So, you know, if this was a wrestling match, this would be a very weak heel turn. This would probably be roundly criticized by most of the major wrestling blogs if, again, this was a professional wrestling match, which it's not, so that's fine. So I guess that's it. I guess that's, yeah, so sure. Phoenix just isn't power mad enough to willingly go with Swan so quickly. And that's a barely, man. That is a barely there pick for me. So, but it doesn't matter. This is a great movie. You guys, if you haven't seen it, why are you listening to this? Turn it off, go get the thing, and then come back and listen to it and subscribe and like us. What do you got, Richard?
Yeah, you would say that right when you were done. No, I agree with George. You should go out and watch this right now.
It's but I mean, come back
movie.
Like when they're done. Come back.
Oh yeah, come back.
Listen to that. Yeah. No.
Perfect. Thank you. That's fine.
Or don't.
You know, whatever. So long
I don't
as
want
you,
to tell you what to do.
As long as you listen to part of it and subscribe is really the most important thing.
And like us, please like
subscribe
us.
Subscribe and like us somewhere. I guess it's my turn. Talk about my least favorite scene in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought process followed yours pretty closely, because it is a hard movie to choose a least favorite scene, and there's not anything that stands out.
There's no fat, really.
There's not. It's a short movie.
Yeah.
Shorter than I would like it to be, which we'll come back to momentarily.
Uh-huh.
But in terms of what I thought through, you've inspired me to kind of go through my own process.
Yes.
So the first thing is the very beginning of the movie, when we show the Juicy Fruit singing, and we get these tryouts going on. The movie feels hokier at that point than it does throughout the rest of it. And just for the sake of a drinking game, in context, as the movie goes on, that works really well.
Yeah.
But it's just not as good as the rest of the movie. It feels like you're in a different place. And it makes it seem like you're not about to watch a great movie, but you're about to watch a bad movie that's enjoyable because it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
But you quickly move beyond that, because that scene doesn't last very long. But that's not my least favorite scene. I enjoy that scene.
Yeah, and the song is great.
Yeah, the song is fantastic.
All the songs are fantastic, I think.
I agree. There's no argument here.
Oh, we better not be.
So after that, Phoenix's heel turn as well doesn't feel earned. She's never given any indication that she would do that. She's been nothing but a very nice person.
Yeah.
And, you know, that could be a comment on how fame can so quickly change people.
Totally.
So I couldn't quite choose that, because later, going to something else you mentioned, when the Phantom is watching video.
Okay.
It's not so much the, clearly how the video is not actually being recorded on a camera. It's the devil's footage. It's really more of how everything can be sewn up so quickly. The Phantom is locked in the room and has access to the video that tells him everything he needs to do to defeat
Swan.
And that doesn't quite work for me. I mean, it works because I love the movie, but the movie's already really short. It feels like it doesn't need to be. It's only an hour and a half. It feels like you could actually fit a little bit more in there.
Even another scene, maybe, to get you to that vault.
Just something to get you to that point. It's just suddenly everything's going poorly for our hero, for the Phantom. Yep. And then he's watching this tape that tells him everything he needs to do. And then shortly thereafter, he does it and the movie's over.
Right.
And I just feel like the ending is rushed. I would love for the ending to take a little bit more time. It would be more satisfying. It doesn't really change my enjoyment of the movie at all. I just think that's the weakest part, is the ending feels rushed because everything everything is sewn up so quickly by this videotape.
Now, the actual ending where it's all on stage and it's all chaos, that's...
that's great.
That's incredible. I also didn't quite understand why Phoenix had to be killed on stage other than it would just be good publicity. This also came out several years before Network did, where... spoiler alert, Network people, if you haven't seen Network, watch that before you hear the rest of this. But
or also, if you're listening to this a year and a half in the future, please check out our Network episode.
Yeah. Boy, that's a terrible movie. Am I lying? Find out next year.
Find out.
All right. That's solid. I had similar thoughts there. Wow.
Yeah, so there you are.
Boy.
But this, in terms of how this movie looks and the way it moves, like you were saying, I was looking into the cinematographer, Larry Pizer, who has almost nothing notable on his resume other than this movie, which just goes to show how much De Palma was driving the cinematography because all of his movies look this way while having different cinematographers. It's just the look of this movie is far more modern than 1974. It certainly has been incredibly influential, as a lot of directors who are making movies right now will tell you, like Edgar Wright or Guillermo del Toro, are heavily influenced by this movie.
This one movie.
And, you know, when I was watching it, rewatching it over the weekend, someone who was watching it with me said, do you think a lot of people were watching Rocky Horror and deciding to, like, make, before she actually saw the whole movie, like, make sort of knockoffs of it?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, this came out before Rocky Horror, and is made. And then she was like, "Oh, it's made by Brian De Palma."
Yeah, right.
This is.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I apologize for claiming that it was some sort of knockoff.
Yeah, I think I saw Rocky Horror before this. I at least was aware of Rocky Horror before this.
I certainly did.
And I thought, like, oh, Beef. That's like a riff on Meatloaf playing Rocky, and it's kind of refreshing that they both happened simultaneously, basically. And
again, yeah, there's no way
something in the water. There was something in the water in the mid 70s where it's let's kind of go into this weird Vincent Price world, but with a bizarre sexual bent to it.
Yeah, because there's no way that Rocky Horror was heavily influenced by this, because they're very close together. To Rocky Horror, they just happened independently of each other.
I think the Rocky Horror stage show was already happening at this point. And so if Rocky Horror came out almost, like, literally 11 months later in 1975, they were probably filming the Rocky Horror Picture Show even before Phantom of the Paradise was released. So it's just, you know, something's in the air. All of a sudden you got 5 meteor movies.
That's just how it works.
That's how it works, man.
People are influenced by similar things. People have similar ideas. They go to similar schools. They talk to similar people.
Yep.
And that's what you end up with.
Did you know that Deep Impact, we're talking about meteor movies now, Deep Impact, I believe, was written by the guy who wrote The Player.
Really?
Michael Tolkien.
Good job getting paid for Deep Impact.
It's got a more emotional weight than Armageddon does. But anyway, please go see Phantom of the Paradise. But also, don't watch the trailer. It's not a very good trailer, and it gives a lot of the plot away.
Yeah, the trailer gives a lot of the plot away, and it does make it seem like a very corny...
Yeah.
It's a fun trailer, but don't judge the movie based on the trailer.
Although, if you've gotten this far and you haven't seen the movie already, we've spoiled a lot of it for you, so that's on you.
Again, if you've gotten this far and you haven't seen the movie already, and you're not our friend, that's weird.
Yeah.
That seems unlikely.
A little bit rude.
So, now it's time to move on to our bad film of the evening, which is Phantom of the Opera.
Is now a major motion picture. You love the music. I am the music.
A lot of people are dead, Mr. Dutton, and the murderer is in your house. Someone is doing murder in Christine Day's name. Our souls are one.
No!
Robert Englund is...
You're him, aren't you?
The Phantom of the Opera. The Phantom of the Opera. Only love and music are forever.
Phantom of the Opera, released in 1989, actually was a production from the 21st Century Film Company. And that is Menachem Golem of the Go-Go Boys, the Canon Film Group. Once they disbanded or went bankrupt and then sued the shit out of each other, Menachem started 21st Century and put out this. I think he also, I feel like he maybe put out the Night of the Living Dead remake. So yeah, this was like a really big flagship moment for him. And what's fascinating is that this movie's odd. It's an odd movie. It stars Robert Englund, who at this point, I think they were going into Nightmare on Elm Street, geez, I want to say 5, probably 4, somewhere in there, but still wildly popular. When you look at this thing, actually, if you even look at the trailer of it, it is really handsomely shot. It looks good. The score is really lovely. And so you think maybe this is one of those moments where the Canon Film Group would go for a really highbrow moment, like a really swing for the fences. Like they made Barfly and Runaway Train and one of Cassavetes' last films, Love Streams, and even Life Force, as weird as it is really a gorgeous looking film, you know, naked sex vampires aside. But this really does feel like a big deal. It feels like maybe a prestige picture instead of a cheap cash grab like Missing in Action or flogging an aging franchise like Superman 4 The Quest for Peace or any of the Death Wish sequels, though I adore Death Wish 3. I will fight anyone who challenges that movie to my face. So yeah, it's going along. The acting's okay. Side note, this is the film debut of the great, great comic performer, Molly Shannon. Wow, their costumes and the cinematography and the locations, it's all going so swimmingly, and then this happens.
Your bumbling was the work of Aegon.
Nah, it was an accident.
But you blamed me.
Won't happen again.
No, it won't. You're suspended.
So, yeah, that's the first hint that this is not, in fact, a prestige picture. You know, the more you watch it, it's essentially just a slasher movie. Shoehorned into a classic horror franchise or a horror property, I should say. Though I want to note in the end credits, there's a disclaimer and it says, "This motion picture is not associated with any current or prior stage play or motion picture of the same title." This is important because this movie came out at the height of the Phantom of the Opera Broadway experience. I mean, this was the hottest goddamn thing in the world. And so it looks like a prestige picture, but this is a classic Canon film style cash grab. Regardless, there are some great surreal Euro horror touches to the way the film is shot. Also, the makeup effects are insanely good, insanely disgusting. I mean, it's repulsive. If you love close-ups of someone using a big hooked needle to sew skin onto their scarred face, then, boy, this is the movie for you.
It sure is.
The thing with the ear, though, when he pulls his ear off, it was just like, how did they do that? Kevin Yeager did the effects, and he's done some of the Nightmare on Elm Streets, and the dude is a genius. It's disgusting. It's repulsive. It is not necessary to the story, and it almost got them an X rating. But it's incredible work. It's really some fine, fine makeup effects. So that's basically it. I will say a few other things. Robert Englund plays the Phantom, and you know, best known by film audiences as the director of 976 Evil and nothing else. I have two personal anecdotes before I throw it to you, Richard. The first one is my dad took me to a V/ Star Trek convention in LA when I was a little kid. I mean, little. V was on, so this must have been 84 or something. And Robert Englund was signing autographs, as well as the guy who played Kirk's son in Star Trek 2 and 3. No one wanted the autograph from the guy from Star Trek, even though I got his autograph. And he's also in a fantastic film called Death Spa. But Robert Englund had a line out the door, and with all these metalheads and like horror freaks and just, you know, the real weirdos, like the guys who don't fit in a Star Trek convention. But Robert Englund was just one of the sweetest guys I'd ever met. And if you watch his work on V, that really shines through. My other story also revolves around my dad and my brother, Dan. We were supposed to go have Thanksgiving dinner at one of his friends' houses, but there was some kind of drama and Thanksgiving was canceled. So
for everybody?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that they were getting a divorce and it was just, it's canceled. Nobody come over. It's going to be a big, big dinner party.
I think I remember that from my own life.
Those kind of, yeah,
where it's that like, happens.
So everyone's scattered to the winds, and I feel like we got burgers or something, or maybe got a pizza, and then my dad took us to we lived in L.A. or near L.A., and we went out to see a double feature in the Valley, and it was Shocker, Wes Craven's Shocker, which is great, and Phantom of the Opera, this version of Phantom of the Opera, and it was great. So we watched 2 hours of 1989's best and finest theatrically released horror films. And that was one of the best Thanksgivings of my life. So I have a special place in my heart for this film. And with that, I'm going to throw it to you, Richard. What is your take on the best scene in Dwight H. Little's Phantom of the Opera, 1989?
First, that was beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for that. You pointed out, of course, it's Molly Shannon's first film.
Yeah.
It's the very first thing in our IMDb profile, well before Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
When I saw her come on screen, my thought was, that woman looks a lot like Molly Shannon.
Right.
And then it was Molly Shannon.
Yeah. She talks like, oh, it is.
It's very unexpected. And she happens to be part of one of the only good parts of this movie. I would consider this Phantom of the Opera to be an interesting, fairly good sort of 1980s Manhattan horror movie. Mm-hmm. About 10 minutes of that, mm-hmm. interrupted by about 80 minutes of a terrible knockoff of a British period drama that happens to include murder. Uh-huh. It's the very first scene that includes Molly Shannon in a library, a great looking library, a very Ghostbuster library,
sure.
sort of basement. This might be a fun movie,
yeah,
is what I thought to myself. And then we go back in time,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not long after that, and we spend most of the movie back in time. And like, oh, it's not a fun movie. It's actually the opposite of what I just said.
Yeah.
So for me, it wasn't that hard to choose my favorite scene because it would come from the bookends that take place in Manhattan, which are both great. I genuinely enjoy all the scenes that occur in New York in the modern 1980s. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're kind of knockoffs of other things,
yeah,
but they
yeah.
still move. They still feel good. Robert Englund, when he appears at the end as a sort of Manhattan theater producer, is great.
Yeah.
He's wonderful. I would love to have seen a whole movie with him playing that character. And I kind of wonder if they just shot the middle, which is most of the movie. The middle is a very strong word and not a very weak word to use for what it was, because it was 90% of the movie.
Well, let's say there's a prologue and there's an epilogue.
Yes, and then there's the movie.
And then there's the log.
The prologue and epilogue take place in Manhattan. And those scenes, again, are great. And Robert Englund's only in the epilogue in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
He's really, really good. I would have... He's creepy and interesting, mm-hmm. and I would love to see more of that. But what I don't need to see is, the period drama that occurs
mm-hmm.
in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So my favorite scene is... It's actually hard for me to choose between two.
Okay.
It either is the first scene in the library, because there's just a lot. It's leading. It's making you feel like this might be interesting.
Yeah. It's atmospheric as hell.
Very atmospheric. You have our lead character discovering music that starts to bleed, and the effect of the bleeding pages. Mm-hmm. It's great.
It's pretty cool.
It's really, really cool. And then at the end, again, you have Robert Englund playing this producer who is amazing. But my gut feeling is to go with the opening scene at the library, which is Molly Shannon's main scene.
Yeah.
Because I still felt like this movie might be underrated. And so I wish that they had made a movie that was entirely in Manhattan, that was a modern Phantom of the Opera, that did not feel this weird need to go back to late 1800s London and do a very bad job of that. That very first scene, that's my favorite scene. I enjoyed it, and that's when my joy stopped until 80 minutes later when Manhattan came back.
Interesting. We have some similar takes on this. I will list my options, the ones I almost went with. So I didn't have as much of a problem. I think it was because I had that childhood connection to this movie. It's not a great film. I'll say that now. I haven't seen many of the other versions of it. I feel like if you have Phantom of the Paradise, you really don't need much more. It's great. And there is a Faustian deal in this. And I almost picked that scene. The scene, I guess it's the Faust deal with the devil scene, where there's the little person. The reason that I like this scene is that it shows that sweet side to Robert Englund. The side that you saw if you watched the show and miniseries is V, that it's not just this, Robert Englund is not just like this scary child murderer like Freddy Krueger. He's actually, there's something quite lovely about him as a performer. And I actually think that if you had more scenes of him, maybe after he had made that deal, struggling to realize that no one loved him, that he was this beautiful, sweet soul, but couldn't find any love for anything other than his art and lived this shallow, one-dimensional life, that would have made the film actually deeper and more compelling and a richer experience. And it might even make you overlook some of the more slasher, hokey elements like...
Still hungry for an introduction? Just open your purse. And what will you trade? Steel. For gold.
That's bad. That's a dumb scene. Okay. That's pandering. Sure. Yeah. But still, I would have loved to just, as a fan of Robert Englund, see more of that. More of his range. Also, because we don't have more of that, you can't ever really root for the Phantom. Unlike Phantom of the Paradise, where, you know, I almost feel like in Phantom of the Paradise, when they turn Phoenix dark so quickly, or so easily... it's there, so it's like, oh, you guys might have forgotten to root for the Phantom. Maybe it's like to offset because like Beef has just been killed and Beef is so great. It's like, but wait, this, what about this poor bastard who is suffering? It's got metal teeth.
That's so true. I mean, it is true. The Phantom in the Phantom of the Paradise is the hero, and the Phantom of the Phantom of the Opera is the villain.
Is the villain, absolutely. He is Freddy Krueger. He's not Freddy Krueger. He's more Jason Voorhees. So all right, so we'll get down to it. I picked the audition scene. This scene almost feels like it's in the wrong movie because it's almost virtuosic. When it really turns, when it really gets weird, it gets real weird and it stays weird, and it's the sound design is so shrill and it throws you off balance. There's one shot, a sandbag comes loose and the whole mirror, again, back with mirrors, this mirror shatters, and you see this shard of a mirror. You see the lead actress reflected in this shard of a mirror seconds before a sandbag smashes that shard, all in one shot. It's for a fairly cheap 1989 horror film. Like, it's kind of like the audience doesn't deserve that kind of quality. It's so good.
It is. They watched that on the monitor and said, and just like, we're like, that shot's amazing.
It's
and
amazing.
They went, and they just felt great about their day because it is an amazing shot. You can just tell that shot was planned out.
And I'm also fine with the repetition of the horse-drawn carriage coming around that corner in 19th century London. Hungary. But all of that works to be a really effective and compelling time travel component where, you know, you are now caught in the vortex and you're back in time. I love that whole sequence. Yeah, it's kind of like, all right, we got that. Fuck the rest of it. We can just phone it in. But I do think that there is something to be said. I cannot write this film off. I think Robert Englund does some interesting work here. I know that he worked with Kevin Yeager to design a face with that almost stage star chin and nose that he really wanted to, instead of wearing that half mask that's always been the thing, he wanted the sewn-on skin mask, which is fucking disgusting, to be of movie star proportions. And I think that this does... It gives him a little bit of room, or gave him a little bit of room to flex his muscles as an actor. I just wish it had been a better vehicle and not just a straight up slasher film.
Yeah, me too. There's a lot of potential.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything I watched, I in no way hate this movie.
No.
It's not a movie that I would recommend anybody watch.
You could do worse, but you could do better. As far as Robert Englund's career is concerned, you can do worse. But you can also do better.
That's a very middle-of-the-road kind of bad movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the effects on his face were absolutely incredible.
You know what? If you are studying to be a makeup effects artist, or if you have any kind of fascination around that, I absolutely recommend this. The close-up makeup effects in this are incredible.
They really are.
There's a thing that happens with an ear in this. I know we mentioned it a little bit, but it's just... I can't quite get my head around how gnarly it is to watch and how realistic it feels. This is how it sounded for good chunks of this movie. Oh, God. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. So there was a lot of that. And if you enjoy making those kind of noises in the comfort of your own home, please rent Phantom of the Opera, 1989.
And it's a short movie.
Yeah.
Available on Amazon Prime.
Yep.
It's a great place to watch it. So it's about time to wrap up. And what we always do, of course, here on Worst Scene is talk about whether the best scene in our bad movie is better than the worst scene in our good movie. And I'll start.
Yep.
And I will say that this is the first time this is true. The best scene in Phantom of the Opera is worse than the worst scene in Phantom of the Paradise to me that I chose.
Yeah, I see that with your selections, absolutely. I almost feel like it's a tie, but no. I think like a lot of the technical work is so good in the Phantom of the Opera scene that I'm talking about. When you guys see it, it's really, really stellar work. It's separate from the rest of the film. It's great. It's hypnotic. But I feel like because Phantom of the Paradise, you can't really separate one scene from the next. It all bleeds together. There's no way for me to vote against it. Is that too subjective of an answer?
I mean, no, there's no rules in this area.
Right.
So no, I think you can call it sort of a tie.
I'd say it's a tie leaning towards Phantom of the Paradise.
And on that note,
yeah,
let's end our third episode of Worst Scene, Best Scene.
Happy Halloween, everybody.